As I indicated, our next case is 824-1562 in the matter of the petition of Minnesota Association of as all parties are aware, the petitioner will have 15 minutes for their arguments in chief, respondent will have 15 minutes, and finally the petitioner will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Whenever counsel for the petitioner is ready, just approach the podium, adjust it up to your, whatever level you want, and adjust the microphone, and please begin by telling us who you are in a loud, clear voice.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Jason Steck. I represent the appellant, Minnesota Association of Residential Service Homes, or MARSH. Acts speak louder than words. Since this appeal has been filed, DHS has made further acts part of the public record that defy its arguments in this appeal to be claiming that it does not enforce unadopted rules governing its determinations of what constitutes a primary residence and primary caregiver for the purposes of Minnesota Statute Section 245A, requirements on adult foster care homes. Specifically,
is this information in the record before us?
It's not part of this record, but it's part of the public record because it's a determination that has been made by the commissioner and is part of the, it can be found in Westlaw and cited.
What authority do you have that says we can consider that?
We can look at it because it is a public document published as a determination by DHS, and it relates to a case that is cited in this record, and that's the Abdullah case, which at the stage that this appeal was filed had been a report and recommendation had been produced by the ALJ, but it was pending the final decision by the commissioner. The commissioner has now made that final decision. So it's just essentially the court taking note of successive developments in a case that both of the parties cited and discussed previously. And what's important here is what happened as a legal consequence. There's no factual changes here except for the determination by the commissioner. I'm not asking the court to acknowledge any new facts except that the commissioner has issued a decision that treats the criteria that DHS has laid out in primary residents as rules.
Isn't that in the circumstance of the issue that you're raising actually a fact?
It's a fact about the development of a case, not a fact about a record out there in the world. It's not an addition of a fact. It's a change in the department's legal analysis that contradicts what it's going to be arguing here today. And I think it's important that the court note that that's happening, because otherwise DHS can come in and argue one thing and do completely another thing as long as it does it while the appeal after the appeal's filed and before it's decided. It's important that the court understand that DHS is saying one thing and doing another. Because DHS is arguing here that it does not enforce its criteria for defining primary caregiver as an unadopted rule because it just looks at them as evidentiary factors on a case-by-case basis.
So, and I don't want to belabor this, we can check the Abdullah case, but, I mean, so in that case, did DHS say, you know, you're right, it is a rule? I mean, what is the significance of this case?
What they did is they took, as they have in other cases, factors that support license revocation and treated those factors as always dispositive. Other factors that do not support revocation, DHS either ignores entirely by refusing to investigate them, or simply disparages them and says they're less important than these other factors as a matter of law. What it specifically did in the Abdullah case was say
that may be an argument that they're applying, they're acting in some arbitrary and capricious manner. But I think what I want to understand is, you know, why is the ALJ's decision wrong when it seems to be that they are applying, you know, a statutory law on a case-by-case basis? Why is that wrong?
The primary reason that that's wrong is because that's not what case by case, what they're doing is not what case by case application means. What case by case application means is that to the degree that there are multiple factors that weigh into something, that there's a process of investigating those factors and then weighing the evidence against each other. That's a case by case analysis. If DHS was weighing them against each other and making a determination as to weight, maybe that's a case-by-case analysis. But the example cited in here, and the reason I pointed to the Abdullah case is because it's just so much more clear and obvious in that case, what we see DHS doing is not a process of comprehensively gathering information and then weighing factors against each other. It is a selective discovery of factors designed from the outset and in the implementation to always just identify the factors that favor license revocation. Thus, each of the factors is a rule. They're just choosing which set of rules to apply in each case. There's no weighing. There's never even an investigation of factors. What DHS is doing in each of these cases is it investigates, it finds some initial indications that support license revocation, and then it orders the investigation to stop. It issues a license revocation order. And then it falls to the license holder to say, but what about these? And when that happens, DHS, again, always does exactly the same thing. It does not say, oh, we'll look at that and reweigh it. They simply say, that's not important here. The only thing that matters is the things we found. In every case, there's no weighing. DHS, not a single example can be found in the record. Well, there was one case once when DHS did do weighing. But other than that, there's not a single case since 2021 when DHS started its aggressive enforcement campaign on this issue and, in fact, created these factors. DHS has not engaged in any process of deliberation or weighing. It has always asserted the same position that whatever it found as violations in that case are the only things that matter and nothing else matters. So, for example, in the Yusuf case, DHS found evidence that to them indicated that Mr. Yusuf was residing in an apartment other than the AFC facility and that he had received parking tickets or other traffic infractions in that area of the other facility, not where the AFC was. And then when Mr. Yusuf produced his driver's license record and said, but my driver's license, which is on your list of factors, says that I live at the AFC, they said, that doesn't matter because we're only looking at this. And that shows where you spend the majority of your time. Okay, that standing by itself might indicate a case-by-case analysis. But in the Abdullah case, we had exactly the reverse factual situation. We had the evidence from the license holder that they had numerous witnesses that had observed them living there. As a matter of fact, the testimony was consistent that nobody had ever seen the license holder living anywhere else. And that's what the ALJ ultimately said. This constitutes a preponderance of the evidence. And in the final commissioner's order that I'm referencing, the commissioner said, no, none of that matters. We're not concerned about where we've been seen because it wasn't on the same day as the license revocation. I'm only looking at the driver's license and the other addresses you put on government documents as official statements. So each one's a rule. It's just choosing when to apply the rule as completely presumptively outweighing everything else. In one case, you'll have official statements, so this is the only one that matters. That's a rule. But in another case, it's like, no, that doesn't matter because I'm concerned about where you spend the most of your time. That's a rule. They're just applying different rules in different cases. But each one is being applied as a rule. There's no weighing process going on.
have two questions. I'm looking at the addendum, and it lists all these cases, and maybe I don't want to waste your time, but maybe you can show us, of the ones listed, which ones you're talking about that sort of... I mean, there's a list of cases on starting 4, 5, 6, 7. So which one are you talking about? And you said they were both cited, so I'm just assuming this is one of them.
I could find it quickly. Yusuf case is on page 5. It's the fourth case listed.
I have the Yusuf case. I'm talking about the one you're saying, which Judge Wheelock was questioning whether that's in the record.
That's the Abdullah case. It's at the bottom of page 5.
Okay, thank you.
And that's the case that's had the subsequent activity.
This argument seems very different from the one that I read on your brief. What I'm hearing now is it seems like the argument is being made that the department is applying the factors incorrectly and thus acting in an arbitrary, capricious manner versus these factors are really a rule which they've adopted improperly. So explain to me why, I guess I just don't understand the argument you're making now. That doesn't seem to be like the argument that's in the briefs.
And I've gotten sucked down.
Saying like, well, one of the factors is the driver's license, and then there's other factors, and you're saying, well, he showed the driver's license supported me, and they relied on these other factors, but there's 11 of them, and they're kind of all, not one of them seems to be dispositive. So what's going on in terms of the argument?
I've gotten pulled down a little bit of a rabbit hole of my own making here, and this was intended to be an argument to illustrate one point about the department's claim that it's engaging in case-by-case analysis. It's not intended to reflect the whole argument. The other point I wanted to make about the department's argument is that their claim is essentially twofold here, that these aren't being enforced with the full force and effect of law and that they're doing it as a case-by-case analysis. My point on the case-by-case analysis is that what differentiates a case-by-case analysis from the imposition of a rule is this deliberative process, this weighing of contrary evidence, and that's not happening. And that's what I intended to provide an illustration for, and I've gotten pulled down into a trap of my own making. But I also want to answer the point about the full force and effect of law, because the department's position here is frankly laughable. The department's position is, well, they don't have the full force and effect of law because the appellant or the license holder gets to have an administrative hearing, and it's not determined until after that they have full legal effect. That's the same as saying that a criminal statute has no legal does not have the full force and effect of law because the defendant always has the right to a trial. That's not the standard. The question is, is the department applying these factors as requirements, yes or no? And the 2023 letter from Mary Kelsey is explicit. It says, you are required, and this is a letter to the license holders, you are required to comply with all statutes and rules in addition to the requirements in this letter. That is unambiguously a statement that these are intended to have the full force and effect of law, just like the rules and statutes do. And they are actually being applied that way to issue orders of license revocation. When DHS finds the violations that they think they can find, then they say, here's a order of revocation. Your license is revoked. That is subject to an appeal process, but the revocation is immediate. And it is only stayed if there is an appeal filed.
That these are, in fact, unpromulgated rules, then don't we move on to the sort of the even if argument, right? So could you explain how these rules are not consistent with or authorize the plain and unambiguous language of the statutes that apply?
2 points on that. First of all, the consistent with is problematic because the standard of review here is de novo. This court determines if the rules are compliant with the law. It's not for the agency to do that. That is a judicial function that is not a function of the agency to do. So the requirement is not that they be merely consistent with, but that has to actually reflect the law. Secondly, The primary caregiver requirement evidence there illustrates the second point even more clearly, because it's not merely about being consistent with, you have to select the right interpretation. It may be the case that an interpretation is consistent with the statute as a whole, but is not the correct interpretation, because when you compare it, when you adopt the canons of adopting...
Interpretation that primary caregiver means the person who provides the majority of the caregiving?
Right, and what the department ignores in its brief is the fact that there this is an ambiguous statute, because in the HCBS statutes, which the court, which the ALJ expressly noted are intertwined because they usually occur in the same environment, there is a definition that is different from the departures from the department's definition, and it makes no sense to have these in the same home where there's two different definitions of the same term.
All right, thank you, Mr. Steck. Your time has expired. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is R.J. Dietrich. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent, the Department of Human Services, in this matter.
Could you speak up and adjust the microphone a little bit more? I'm having a little hard time hearing you.
Sorry about that.
That's much better. Thank you, Mr. Dietrich.
I'll try and speak up. The court should affirm ALJ Mosang's order denying Marsh's petition here for a couple of reasons. First of all, the department does not enforce any memo or letter policy as if it were a duly adopted rule with the force and effect of law. Instead, the department enforces the primary caregiver requirement and the primary residence requirement that apply to family adult foster care homes on a case-by-case, fact-specific basis. Second, even if the court were to determine that the department was enforcing, you know, some policy or memo or other similar pronouncement as if it were a duly adopted rule, the ALJ's order denying Marsh's petition should still be affirmed because the department's interpretation and explanation of the primary residence primary caregiver requirements are fully consistent with and thus authorized by the plain and unambiguous language of the relevant statutes.
What are we to make of Mr. Steck's point about the letter from Ms. Kelsey on page 2? As a family adult foster care license holder, you are required to operate within the guidelines. He puts great weight on that, as to say, it's not really a guideline, it's a rule. So what's your response to that, Mr. Dietrich?
Your Honor, a couple things. First of all,
lawyers didn't review the letter before it went out?
I don't know the answer to that question. Your Honor, a couple things. First of all, 245A.09, subdivisions 8 and 9, specifically authorized the department to publish interpretations of the relevant statutes and rules that it enforces, the licensing statutes and rules that it enforces, that do not have the force and effect of law. And that's all that the department was doing here with the letter and with the other memo. And the big thing that the appellant takes issue with in the letter is the statement that the license holder's immediate family should live with the license holder in the family adult foster care home. But that's stated as an expectation. I mean, I don't think there's any reason to believe, and there's certainly no actions that have been pointed to, that the department has ever revoked a license or determined that a license is not someone's primary residence solely because their immediate family does not live in the licensed home. And in fact...
Hence the 12 factors.
Sorry, Aaron?
Hence all these factors about what's the address in the driver's license, where do they sleep majority. So it's a variety of things that you take into consideration, correct?
Well, yes, Your Honor. There's also the separate memo that lays out several factors and said these are factors that may be considered in determining whether a foster care home is the primary residence of the license holder. It's clear from the language there that even that long list of factors is not exhaustive. It's not limiting the things that can be considered. It's just saying that these are factors that may be considered. And it even calls for case-by-case enforcement within some of those factors where it says, like, if the I believe it says that if the spouse of the license holder does not live in the home, then the licensor should consider whether that's reasonable under the circumstances. That's case-by-case enforcement. I mean, the memo is simply calling for case-by-case enforcement. And as to the letter and the memo, you also have, there's also a subsequent document from Dakota County. Counties have some delegated licensing authority from the department in this area. And which Marsh put in the record, indicates that Dakota County would engage in case-by-case enforcement of the primary residence requirement and would only revoke a license if the license holder was not actually living in the licensed home. I want to briefly also touch on the cases that petitioner mentioned just now in the opening argument. First of all, the Abdullah case, that's a case where the commissioner, the department revoked based on the fact that the foster care was not the license holder's primary residence. And the commissioner did that for a number of reasons that I think clearly support that decision. One of those reasons was that the license holder's son, who actually worked at the foster home, told DHS license holders point blank, my mom, who's the license holder, doesn't live here. She lived with me over there across the street. I mean, if that's not a reason to conclude that the license holder doesn't live at the home, I don't know what is. In addition, respondent also or appellant also cites the Yusuf case. I must confess that I don't remember all the facts of the Yusuf case, but the Yusuf case was another case where the department revoked based on a determination that the home was not the license holder's primary residence. This court recently affirmed that determination. So clearly, this court believed that it was supported by the record. And I don't really understand petitioner's argument that the department doesn't weigh the evidence. I mean, obviously the cases that we have a record of are cases where the department has revoked a license and there's been an appeal. And of course, in its revocation orders and in its presentation at any contested case hearing, the department is obviously going to focus on the reasons it decided to revoke its license, to revoke the license or decide that it wasn't the primary residence of the license holder. That doesn't mean that it didn't conduct a full investigation.
No, in all fairness to Mr. Steck, I mean, the Yusuf case is not a challenge that these are unadopted rules. It was more that the commission made, you know, misapplied the factors. Although we do say on the first page, that DHS issued a guidance document that lists some of the factors. So I don't know if that means we're bound by that, but at least the Court of Appeals, in addressing this once before, seemed to suggest these were guidance, not rules. But getting to the heart of Mr. Steck's appeal, so why should we, what's your best argument that this is not rules, it's merely guidance?
Well, Your Honor, a couple things. I mean, I'd point you again to 245A.09, subdivisions 8 and 9, which specifically allow the department to publish interpretive guidance on
how to apply the...
Right. And then I'd also point you to the fact that the department has never cited the memo or the guidance as a basis for agency action. It's never cited it as its authority for agency action. What the department does when it takes an agency action against a license holder based on the primary residence requirement or the primary caregiver requirement is cite the rules and the statutes, not the memo or the letter or the guidance.
So you would agree then that the language you would say then in this memo or letter is inaccurate? You are required to operate within the guidelines outlined.
Well,
if that's not precedent, I mean, there's an allowance for guidelines that do not have the effect of law or precedential effect. But if you declare that you are required to act within those guidelines, why is that not the effect of law? and suggest a precedential effect?
Well, again, Your Honor, I mean, the statute 14.381 that we're dealing with here only allows this court to order the agency to cease enforcing a memo or documented as if it has the force and effect of law. And that, my argument is that the department isn't doing that. The department relies on the statutes and rules, not the memo and the letter as authority and for its actions. And I believe.
What would you have us characterize if we were to say the meaning of that? You know, you are required to operate within the guidelines as well as the statutes and as well as the rules, treating them all in the same. It looks like the letter is treating them all the same. So you would say what as we should say what as to the meaning of that or the application of that
provision? Well, I mean, certainly as to the primary caregiver requirement, I mean, the department does believe that that is what the statute requires. As to the, you know, the expectation, which is stated in the letter, that the immediate family members live in the home, I mean, certainly that's consistent with whether the home, you know, if the immediate family members don't live in the home, that's an indication that it may not be the license holder's primary residence. But I don't think you can read from that letter that the letter is saying, oh, that means you automatically have to revoke if that's not the case. And there's no indication that the department has ever done that. And the subsequent guidance from Dakota County, which actually references the letter, says that that's not going to happen. So I guess that would be my answer to that. I mean, I guess maybe.
So you would say that that phrase was an overstatement that's not actually applied in every circumstance?
Yes, Your Honor. Perhaps it was a little.
Erroneous?
A little bit. It went a little bit too far, a little bit of a misstatement. As to the other argument, regardless of how you view the letter, or the notice, regardless of whether you view them as being enforced as if they were duly adopted rules, the fact is that the department's interpretations here are consistent with the plain and unambiguous language of the relevant statutes and rules. As to the primary caregiver, the primary residence requirement, primary residence isn't defined in the statute, but the statute requires that the foster home be the license holder's primary residence, requires the department, not just allows the department, but requires the department to revoke if that's not the case. Primary residence, primary is defined in dictionary definitions as a first rank or importance. A residence is where you live. I think clearly primary residence means the place where the person lives most of the time, and that's how this court appears to have interpreted it in past decisions. And those factors in the memo, as well as the factor listed in the letter, are all clearly consistent and relevant considerations in determining whether where someone lives most of the time. Things like where they get mail, where they spend most of their time, where they sleep most of the time, where they have listed their residence address for purposes of their driver's license. These are all unquestionably relevant to that determination. And again, it's not a exhaustive list. So, Your Honor, you know, on that basis alone, because they're consistent with the plain and unambiguous language of the statute, the court should affirm on that score. In addition, I would note that I don't believe that the ALJ found that was the case. I don't believe Marsh addressed that as to the primary residence requirement in its brief at all. So it's waived any argument as to that. As to the primary caregiver requirement, the statutes require that the license holder be the primary caregiver in the foster home. The department in the letter and the memo interprets that to mean that the license holder provides the majority of care in the home. Marsh argues that primary caregiver actually means just being responsible for the care provided in the home, but that just doesn't make sense for a couple of reasons. It's not a reasonable reading of the statute. First, there's a rule that does apply to directly to family adult foster care providers that defines caregiver as someone who actually gives care in the home. So it has to be someone who actually gives care in the home. It can't just be someone who's responsible for care in the home. Second, the statute requires, again, that the licensed holder be the primary caregiver in the home. Appellant's reading would essentially read that requirement out of the statute or make it superfluous, because as the license holder, the license holder is already responsible by definition for the care provided in the home. That's in the definition of license holder in 245A.02. So the legislature must have meant something different than just responsibility for the care provided in the home when it said that the license holder must be the primary caregiver in the home. So, Your Honors, I see that I'm almost out of time, and I would just ask that you affirm the administrative law judge's order denying Marsh's petition. Thank you.
Mr. Dietrich. Mr. Stick, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you. I'd like to make 2 points, the focus of my rebuttal. The first is on the full force and effect of law. What is the difference between guidance and a rule from the perspective of a license holder if you get your license revoked for violating it? It's the same thing. The department keeps saying, well, it's just guidance. We say it's just guidance. Look at what the department does. When its expectations are violated, when its interpretations are violated, when its guidance is violated, it revokes the license. Now, Mr. Dietrich said, no, we're only looking at the cases where it was appealed. No, that's not what's in the record. Look at the court's report and also the underlying arguments to the ALJ. On page 6, or on the 7th page of the addendum, and on the 8th page of the addendum, there are numerous references to where we're looking at the revocation orders themselves, not some subsequent appeal. We're looking at what the department did on its revocation orders. And on page 8, on its denial orders, the same thing. We're looking at the complete available record of every situation where the department has issued a license revocation on an AFC since 2021, where it's dealing with the primary residence definition. And we see the same behavior in every case, that they look at the violations and they deem whatever those violations are to be dispositive and nothing else matters. Every case. They are not weighing. That's the difference. The second point I'd like to make is that this idea that the majority of care has to be provided. What the department overlooks here is that consistency with the language of the statute only helps the department's position if it is consistent with the unambiguous language of the statute, which means the court has to first make a determination of whether the statute is unambiguous or not. If the statute is ambiguous, then the department's position is not rescued by its claim to be consistent with the language of the statute. And a statute is ambiguous if it is susceptible to more than one interpretation. Now, we know for a fact that the primary caregiver requirement is susceptible to more than one interpretation, because the department's own regulations in the HCBS field state that alternative definition. So right there, we've got two, according to the department, interpretations of the same statutes, the same statutory language that differ. So we have an ambiguous statute. And it really matters in this context, and here's why. A lot of AFC license holders are also HCBS license holders. So the question is, if they're providing services, which of those services are subject to which definition? Because we've got two definitions. We've got one for HCBS services, which merely says you have to be the overseer, and we've got one that says an AFC that's saying from the department you have to provide the majority of all care provided in the home. Since a lot of the care being provided in the home is HCBS care, does the license holder have to provide a majority of that care or not? And the department's position has always been, as in the Chaga case, which is referenced in the, and that's C-A-G-A, as is referenced in the addendum, the department's position is they have to provide a majority of all the care. So what their department is saying is not only is their majority of care requirement a rule for AFC holders, but it's also one for HCBS holders as well, and that it trumps their own definition of primary caregiver for HCBS services if the license holder holds both licenses. There can't be any more clear indication of an unadopted rule if it's being used to actually trump another adopted rule. And that's exactly what the department is doing here. Now, admittedly, the primary residence requirement is a lot more complicated. But what I'd ask this court to focus on is what's the difference between interpretive factors and rules, and that is the weighing process. Unless this court can find evidence in the record that DHS is actually weighing the factors against each other instead of applying them as mandatory, then this court needs to reverse the ALJ's decision and declare that these are unadopted rules. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stick. The matter is submitted.